Turning our attention now to the birds we're finding here in Wisconsin, or maybe not finding. Steve Bechtol of Eau Claire is our guest today, author of all of this, and Robins Too, A Guide to the 50 or So Best Places to Find Birds in Wisconsin, and another book, All This and Titmice Too. He's an award-winning journalist and a freelance writer for a number of publications. I'm really glad to have him back to be with us by phone. And Steve, welcome.
Hi, Larry. How are you?
I'm great. And you just returned from Alaska?
Yeah, it was a great opportunity. I got to visit my son in Denali National Park. I'd never been to Alaska. It was wonderful.
And any new sightings?
Yeah, actually, I saw not only some new bird species, but some new mammalian species and some new wildflowers. I love to look at all of them, and that's what I want to talk about, is the first encounters with a new species today and how people meet birds and animals for the first time and how they fall in love with them.
Yeah, and you wrote a really nice poem, I think, titled When You Fall in Love with Birds. Do you have that poem handy?
You mind if I read it?
Please do. I think it's great.
The actual title is called How, and it goes like this. When you fall in love with birds, will it be because you're courted by colors, black-throated blue and lazuli, rose-breasted and cerulean, by indigo buntings, scarlet tanagers, and purple martins? Will it be jet-black crows that catch you up, or egrets that shine like angels? When you fall in love with birds, will it be because you are hushed by the magnitude of life, by the sky flush with wings? In magnificence, birds do not relent. Will it be their many shapes and personalities that win you, or their grace? When you fall in love with birds, will it be with the music they make, with the morning scored to overflowing, or will you fall for the words themselves? When you fall in love with birds, will it be in the spring when romance is new, or in the fall when you know the music will soon go out? When will it be, and how will it happen, the day you fall in love with birds?
I think that's a great poem. Thanks so much for writing it and for reading it. It's wonderful.
Thank you. It goes to the heart of what I believe about nature study and environmentalism, is that you have to get to know things in order to appreciate them and protect them.
And I guess we could ask people to share some of their memorable nature moments.
Absolutely.
Or maybe describe how they bonded with birds. And certainly be happy to talk about some of those encounters as well. Or other questions that our listeners might have relating to birds. And the number to call again, 1-800-642-1234, or email us at talk@wpr.org. And before you even started reading that poem, Steve, every line was filled.
Good, we got some birders out there, some nature lovers.
Yeah, Roger in Fitchburg's up first, so let's go to Roger. Hi, Roger.
I saw two birds. They were about similar size, and they were largely grayish grayish. One had a red head with streaks of red going down its back. The other, I saw just 5 days ago, yellow. And I'm wondering what in the world they might have been.
A house finch?
Yes. Probably the red is a house finch. The yellow one is a little more interesting. Let me ask you about that. Where was the yellow on the bird?
In both cases on the head, streaking down the back and the sides.
Some house finches show an anomaly of orangish, yellow-orangish on their head. But the house finch is basically a brown-streaked bird with a kind of a... what would you call it? Scarlet red cap, and its color is restricted pretty much to the head, a little bit on the back. The purple finch, which is another Wisconsin bird, has been described as a bird dipped in raspberry juice. It has a little bit more of a deeper tone to it, maybe a more magenta tone to its head, and has a little different body shape too. But you're probably seeing house finches, I would guess. There's no other bird coming to your feeders. What's this, Roger?
Well, no, one I saw going up and down onto the ground, poking away at little growing things on the ground.
Yeah, the only yellow bird that would have yellow on it would be a goldfinch in your yard, and that one would be a little bit more striking, have some bright yellow with some black wings, but it's probably a house finch.
I thought finches were larger. This is about the size of a sparrow.
That's about it.
Sure.
Yeah, that's a house finch. All right, thanks, Roger, for calling. Appreciate it. Mike in Milwaukee, we are on to you. Hi, Mike.
Hi. If I walk along the Bradford-McKinley Beach area in Milwaukee...
Great spot to bird.
Yeah, there's tons of red-winged blackbirds flying around.
Uh-huh.
And a very healthy population. But if I go down to the St. Francis on the south side in that area and walk along the lakefront, the blackbirds have yellow spots. So I tried to call Charles Darwin, and I tried to call Gregor Mendel, but they don't answer. And so I'm wondering if you have an explanation. You know, are these different species?
Well,
are these basically cousins or relatives?
Could be yellow-winged blackbirds.
Yeah.
Well, when you say yellow, are you saying yellow on the wing?
The spot that would be red, these birds look the same, except the spot that would be red is now yellow.
Yeah. Okay. They have actually, they're called red-winged blackbirds. But they actually do have yellow on their wing. They have a little patch of it below the red. And a lot of times when they fluff up the red is called an epaulette. It's kind of, it refers to the corner of the shoulder of a military uniform. But they have these bright red epaulettes. But they also have a little bit of yellow.
No, these birds are totally yellow. And I got to tell you...
Totally yellow.
Yeah. Now, are these? Is this a separate... A family or a tribe? Do birds have tribes? Do they relate to each other like people?
They do have subspecies, and they have variations in coloration. Now, if you're seeing a bird that's yellowish, though, that
would marking. Suggest...
What?
Just the epaulette.
Oh, okay. Yeah, it probably is just a different coloration of the red-winged blackbird, because there is no other bird in Wisconsin that would have yellow on the wing, be a blackbird with yellow on the wing. There's a yellow-headed blackbird.
Well, could this be a recessive trait?
It could be. It could be some coloration that's a little bit mutant. It could be that one bird, what I would suggest is probably that the bird is showing more yellow than usual. And sometimes you look at a red-winged blackbird and you'll see any yellow on the wing at all.
No, these birds are not, they're not uptight. They're not, they're totally relaxed.
Yeah.
They're sitting there and they're not, you know, they're not showing off.
Yeah.
I've seen exactly the same thing on my feeder.
You see the yellow on there.
Yeah.
That's probably the most reasonable explanation is that this is a red-winged blackbird with an inordinate amount of yellow in that epaulette. But, you know, it could be that there is some kind of in South Milwaukee, maybe the breeding population is moving towards a yellow-winged blackbird.
Well, here's an interesting observation for you. When I was walking down there, one of those little yellow-winged blackbirds, I'll call it that, went after a crow and beat the hell out of it.
Common behavior, very aggressive birds, smaller birds will often pick on big birds that pass through their territory. It's like if you go to a World War II analogy, it's like a Messerschmitt coming after a bomber or a Mustang. They're more maneuverable, and they can pick on the big bomber, which cannot maneuver well in the air, but they're sure to stay away from the talons.
Yeah. Thank you, Mike. Appreciate the call very much. I'm going to give some others a chance to join us, so we'll go to Judy in Barrington, Illinois. Excuse me. Hi, Judy.
Hi, Steve. I'm actually on the road headed up into northwestern Wisconsin, and I'm wondering if you're aware of any Kirtland warbler sightings or habitat sleep paths up around North Dells and, again, up around Augusta, some pretty good stands of jack pines, which I know are their habitats, and just wondering if you're aware of any Kirtland warblers in north central or northwestern Wisconsin.
Well, there are several colonies, actually, Judy. There's up in the northeast corner of the state, there are a couple birds, but the hot spot right now is in Adams County, and the spot is a secret. It's not publicly known. It's on private property. I think it's fair to say it's on forest, in a forest of lumber property, some managed by some company that harvests wood, and you have to have permission to go on there. They're expanding at a rate, though, that in given a little time, they may be on public property. But to see them now, you have to actually enter a lottery with the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology, and they take organized bus trips out there. Now, having said that, I have seen them in Jackson County, north of Highway 54. I saw a pair there a few years ago in a jack pine plantation there. But those birds have not returned, as far as I know, this year or last year. And so they are, the way it's going, they're bound to show up in other places, but your chances of seeing one are slim. You can go around Adams County and listen for their song. It's very distinctive, and you may run into one still singing, but you pretty much can't be pointed out to one right now. It'd be a wondrous thing to see them. Everybody's celebrating their existence and their how well they're doing, but they'd be very hard to find.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, but through WSO, you can get some trips to go see them, possibly.
Yes, every year if you join, they send out a lottery, and they ask anybody who's interested to sign up, and then they fill up a couple buses, and you can go on an organized tour and go and see them.
Okay, I have a quick question. Since you just came back from Alaska, and I headed up there next week, did you bird on the Kenai Peninsula at all?
I did. I went to Seward, and I took a boat trip. It was something like Out of the Perfect Storm. I was on an ocean 24-foot Gilligan Island-sized boat in 10 to 12-foot swells of ocean. I had a scopolamine patch, and so I did not get sick, but at moments you trust, it's amazing what you trust your life to. And I saw some great birds.
What was the cruise line you took out of Seward?
There's a Kenai Fjords tour company right in Seward, and every day they set out on several different, the one I went on was a captain's choice. You can, it's more oriented birders. So they'll stop and look at things. We also stopped and look at humpback whales and sea otters. But they'll go to these breeding cliffs around the Chitwell Islands, as well as taking some of the Kenai Fjords glaciers that come into the different fjords around there. But the day we went out, it was so bad. There was a 100-foot vessel ahead of us. We were waiting to see what they did. When they turned around, we turned around, too. There was an open ocean passing around a cape, which the way our captain described it was a bit nautical out there.
And I appreciate your information.
All right. Thanks a lot, Judy, for calling. Appreciate it. And we'll take some more calls. Let's go to Bob in Wauwatosa. Bob, hello.
Good morning, and thank you for taking the call.
Sure.
My wife and I have some land in southwestern Wisconsin, and for the first time we saw cedar waxwings this year that maybe because we didn't observe them prior. So I'm wondering two questions. One, is that their normal range? And second, is there anything we can do to keep them around?
Yes, that is, to both questions. Yes, Bob, they are. That's their normal range. They are breeding in Wisconsin. I don't think they're real. They're not a real apparent bird to a lot of people. They don't have a very loud, flamboyant song. It's not like you're listening to a cardinal. They just kind of twitter. And most people don't know that song. And they nest in rather thick clumps of cedar or other trees, and so they're hard to see. And they're not a very bright bird. And so to see one, you kind of pay attention. But they're around all over the place. And, of course, they group up in the winter. But in the summer, you just have a pair here, a pair there, and they're all over. Yep. And if you are paying attention, you will spot them again. They're certainly in your county by the thousands, and they're across the state by the hundreds of thousands, probably, I could safely say. By the way, red-winged blackbirds, they say there are probably 5 million of those in the state, whether they're red or yellow-winged blackbirds. But there are 5 million of those in the state of Wisconsin, the estimate is. A lot of birds out there, and you will have wax wings for years to come.
Great. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Thanks a lot for calling. Tammy emailed us and says, we live in Amherst, Wisconsin. Recently had a black-billed cuckoo hit our window. We tried to save it, but it was too injured. We've never seen one before. Are they an unusual sighting for central Wisconsin?
Interestingly, there are two cuckoos in Wisconsin, the yellow-billed and the black-billed. The yellow-billed is a more southerly species. It's you could say it's the southeastern U.S. And the black-billed cuckoo is the more northerly of the couple that would be found in Wisconsin, Canada. And so right at where Amherst would be, you get both. In Eau Claire, you get both. In the tension zone that passes through Wisconsin, you get both yellow-billed and black-billed cuckoos. And so they are beautiful birds. But again, they're another secretive species. It's hard to see them. They're kind of skulkers, and they'll hide out in the treetops. And when they flash across a road, you see this, in the case of a yellow-billed cuckoo, this bright rufous flash of wings and this long tail. And if you ever get a close look at them, you see the black-billed has red around the eye, red skin, red flesh around the eye. And so they're very subtly beautiful birds. And so when one strikes your window, it's unfortunate, but it does give you the chance to study how beautiful that bird is. I mean, you don't get to see it very much in real life.
Steve Vetchkal, our guest today, birding expert, as we talk about when you fall in love with birds. Here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, I'm Larry Mueller with Jim Packard, our producer. Taking your birds and birding questions at 1-800-642-1234 or via email at talk@wpr.org. Let's turn to Bob in Jackson next. Hi, Bob.
Well, good morning, Larry, and good morning, Steve.
Hi, Bob.
Good morning. Larry, just as a quick aside, I will save my muskie story for another time. Three Lakes, tail end last week and over the weekend. But we saw a very interesting bird at Jack's Feeder. It was, and I liked your description before of that raspberry coloring for the purple finch. This looked really like a purple finch, but it did have kind of a cream-colored breast with some brown streaks. They weren't spots. They were streaks. And the other thing that totally told me it was not a purple finch is its beak, what looked like a mini grosbeak beak.
Hmm.
It wasn't a thin beak like a purple finch. It was a real thick beak that looked like a real seed cruncher beak.
Sure, that's a good description. Well, where was this again that you saw it?
This just a little north of Three Lakes, so in northern Wisconsin.
Sure. Well, up there, there's a possibility. Have you ever seen a pine grosbeak?
I have not.
Okay, pine grosbeaks are kind of pink in coloration, and they're
the females are actually ochre-colored,
but yeah, they have a pink shade to them, a rosy pink, and they have two white wing bars, but they have a little bit of a bigger beak in comparison to the head size, and you would find them potentially in northern Wisconsin, but they are typically in Canada at this time of year. So as far as reddish birds go, they're also crossbills. But that bird doesn't have a seed-crunching beak. And so when you start to narrow down the birds that would be pinkish, purplish, reddish, there aren't that many that are candidates for birds there other than the purple finch. And
a crossbill. Well, I've got a Peterson's guides 4 feet away from me at the moment.
Well, take a look.
And I'm going to check that out.
The red cross.
And what was the name again? That was a crossbill?
Yes, a red crossbill or a pine grosbeak are possibilities for birds that have reddish coloration in there. Compare them to your purple finch and see if you can figure out which one it is based on what you recall.
Super. Very good. Well, I appreciate it very much. And, Larry, as I say, I'll save the muskie story.
All right. I'm dying to hear it, but we'll hear it on another show, Bob. Thank you very much. All right. Greg in Green Bay, it's your turn. Hi, Greg.
Hey, guys. How are you?
Good.
Good. Hey, I've been an avid grouse hunter since about 10 years of age. I'm about 45. Me and the guys I hunt with, we always, somebody's got a theory as to why the birds 1 year are up and 1 year they're down and all those other things. And if you have any comments on why they are or aren't, that's great. But the question I have is in regards to, let's say this year is supposedly kind of an up year, but one of the things I hear often is that a spring that's wet and cold has a big effect on the nesting and the roosting of the birds and everything. And I guess I'm wondering, you know, when exactly do the females hatch, and then what time frame are you looking if you said, all right, well, yeah, it's wet and cold at this certain time, that's big trouble for those grouse. So I'm just kind of curious as to, your comment on that.
Sure.
They would be breeding in April. I would say it would be safe to say through May. I'm looking up here. Let's see. The exact times would be incubation. All right. Eggs, early April into July. And so that's, when spring is breaking, the snow is melting. Sometimes we get very wet springs. Yeah, any ground nester could have a lot of trouble with some cold and wet weather, although rough grouse would be better adapted because of their northerly range. But pheasants, the same thing happens to those birds. And so that does pick off a lot of birds. A harsh spring is hard on ground nesting birds. And in fact, it's hard on any birds. It can be hard on food supply. Some of the birds go up and down in terms of range as a regular cycle due to predation. There are some things to do with, whether or not bobcat or coyotes are up in population. But that's always been kind of a regular up-and-down, year-to-year thing, that rough grouse become scarce and they bounce back, and that's always the way it's been.
Yeah.
And do you have any comment on what kind of spring we've had during that breeding cycle now?
Actually, this was a decent spring, I would say, although, regionally it depends on where you are and where you hunt. I mean, all through the spring here it was actually rather warm and mild, and so I think it would be a good year for breeding little baby rough grouse.
Okay.
All right. Thanks. Thanks a lot for calling, Greg. Let's turn to Sue in Toma next. Hi, Sue.
Hi. I was wondering, why do the birds crash into the windows in our home? they can't seem to see that they're not supposed to be there.
Yeah, birds have no concept of windows, and so what they see is a dark space, which looks like maybe the understory of the forest. To them, the concept is rather foreign. It's, you know, what is that big dark space? Is it a hole to fly through? They don't have any idea that they're going to be stopped by the glass. The problem is if they're coming from a feeder, too, if they get frightened, something, a hawk comes by the feeder and they get flushed, if they build up enough speed coming from the feeder, the opposite direction from the hawk, they will hit that window with intensity enough to break their neck or push their bill back into their skull, and that's how they often die from the shock of that impact. What you can do a lot of times, you can put your feeder closer to the window. They see themselves in the reflection sometimes. That deters them, but they don't have enough speed to build up to hit the window then. And what people are doing is some people, I think one of the best suggestions is putting netting up over their windows. I think there have been people who have put up silhouettes of hawks, and sometimes that works too. But, you know, if you really want to deter them, then you either pull that feeder away from there, pull it closer, or put some kind of block over the big window. Big picture windows are particularly tough on birds because it looks at them like an open space.
We wanted to do something to stop it.
Yeah. Well, the netting works pretty well, and that's pretty see-through as well.
Yeah, if you don't mind the looking through the netting into your backyard, you can still see the feeders, and it's always a conversation piece, of course. You can explain to people that you're looking out for the birds.
And it reminds me a little bit of a screen, like you'd have a screen on a window.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what it looks like.
Okay, well, thank you.
Give it a try.
Thanks, Sue. And more callers online. Let's go to Jeanette in La Crosse next. Hi, Jeanette.
Hi. I have a comment and a quick question.
Okay.
I just figured, you know, when God made the earth and he loved flowers so much that he wanted to sprinkle them in the sky, and that's why he made birds. And so I wrote a little haiku. You know what a haiku is?
Yeah, oh yeah, 5-7 and 5 syllables.
Right. And it goes like this. If flowers could fly, each rainbow's hue they'd mirror, heavenly bouquet.
Oh.
Very good.
Read that once more.
If flowers could fly, each rainbow's hue they'd mirror, heavenly bouquet.
Oh.
Very good. I just thought you would like that since you love birds. But my question is, somebody in our neighborhood in La Crosse let their parakeet out. And he's, since March, he's been flying around, and he's kind of taken up buddies with the sparrows. And I was just wondering, is he going to survive this winter?
Probably not.
No, you don't think so?
They're not acclimated to our Wisconsin winters, and they will have a hard time making it. First of all, they have no survival instincts in Wisconsin. They're probably used to, it's probably used to being fed by a human, and it probably wouldn't have any idea how to secure a natural food source unless it landed at feeders. So it, unless it's recaptured again, it probably will not do all that well. Whether you're talking about grain or fruit, and at times sometimes they eat fruit too, and that would really be tough on them if they couldn't find that.
So. Yeah, somebody's put out a couple feeders, and he flies from feeder to feeder with the sparrows, but I didn't know if the cold would be too much for him.
Could be. Again, a bird that is used to the cold, a chickadee knows to hunker down in a thick cedar tree and fluff its feathers and has some built-in instinct to match the minus 30 night. I don't know if an exotic parakeet could think that way. It doesn't have the evolutionary adaptation to act that way. So,
well, thank you for your help.
Sure.
Thanks a lot for calling. Dennis in Fond du Lac, it's your turn. Hi, Dennis.
Hello, how are you?
Great, thank you for calling.
Recently in Mariner County, we've been seeing a red-bellied woodpecker, I believe it is. Wondered how common they were, and also a bird we have not seen for many years is a red-headed woodpecker. Do you know the status of those?
Well, the conventional wisdom for both is that the red-bellied woodpecker is expanding its range explosively, and the red-headed woodpecker is shrinking explosively, and there are some reasons for that. The red-belly does very well at feeders. It was a bird, if you go back 20 years ago, of the south and southwest, came to the Illinois-Wisconsin border. Now, to find it in Marinette, that's amazing. It is far north, and you know, typically if you go north, they become scarcer, but the red-headed woodpecker has been having problems for a couple of reasons. One is that it likes oak savanna, and oak savanna is a tough habitat to come by. People tend to cut down old trees, dead trees, for firewood, and there aren't standing snags in the middle of big fields anymore. The other thing that red-headed woodpeckers have had a hard time with is cars. They're a bird of open country, farmland, oak savanna, and they'll fly low across the road and get picked up by cars. And so they have really suffered a lot of fatalities over the years due to automobiles and trucks. And so while their range has been shrinking, the red-bellied is expanding. And so red-bellied is almost to Canada now. So.
We had never seen them until this year.
Yeah.
So, all right, thank you.
All right, thanks a lot for calling. Sally in Spring Green, on to you now. Hi, Sally.
Hi, it's good to be able to talk with people, even though the subject is not as nice as you've been saying, because I'm one of those people who worked for 10 years in the marshes of Louisiana through the Sierra Club and the Audubon and the Delta Sierra and the Audubon Club down there, and I know them, and I'm deeply troubled by the oil problem down there, because I know that a third of all North American species of birds are either permanent or winter residents down there, that no fewer than 411 varieties, more than half the species known to exist in North America, north of Mexico, have been sighted in Louisiana and the Bayou Country, that there are, in winter, over 400,000 ducks, and, you know, our white pelican, we saw 18 here at Bakken's Natural Area this spring, come from the coast of Louisiana. 600,000 acres of that marshland are in wildlife refuges. All of that is gone. Where are all our birds going to go this winter?
Well, somebody asked me the other day, you know, how will this affect migrant birds? And the question is complicated. Migrant birds in general, if you're talking about neotropical migrants, they don't land in the water. They don't land on the beach, typically. And so life will go on as it can. And if you're talking about seabirds, if you're talking about ducks or shorebirds, yeah, it's going to be a horrible impact. And so sea life, in particular, and coral reefs, fishes, coral reefs, those are going to suffer tremendously from this. And a migrant heading over the Gulf, you know, a marsh bird, maybe a wader, is going to have some difficulties with the water coming into the mangrove shorelines or into the marshes as far as it can penetrate. It's a terrible mess, and I'll say one political thing. I don't think we did enough to make sure that these drillers were going to have plans in place to address emergencies, and so we need to be more responsible, I think, when we allow them to drill.
Yeah. Thank you very much for calling.
On the coast of Louisiana, during migration seasons and seeing over 10 species in one small bush, they stop there and rest there, coming both ways. That's absolutely essential, even to those who fly over the Gulf of Mexico or who try to land and live out the winter in the brush on all that grassland.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's all critical habitat in one way or another, whether it's torn up for a shopping center or parking lot, or whether it's smeared with crude oil leaking from a rig.
Yeah. Thank you very much for calling. It is a sad situation that we have there with our aquatic life, our bird life, and our aquatic life. It's a terrible situation. Bruce in St. Louis, Missouri. On to you now. Hi, Bruce.
Hi, how are you? Enjoying your program, traveling through your state. Just recently this year, put out a feeder in my backyard in St. Louis. And all the birds that you've mentioned so far, I do get to come to my feeder. There is a bird, though, that I'm not real sure what it is. It's a bird about the size of a wren, maybe a little bit smaller. It's basically black and gray with a black hooded, black hood and a little, maybe a black around the eye also. Not sure what that bird is. I was wondering if you find it up here, or do you know what that is?
Okay. Now, the bird you're describing is gray and white with a black hood?
Gray and black, basically. I think there's a little white there. I'm not 100% sure now. It's a smaller bird. It is a pair that comes to the feeder.
Okay, and it's not a black-capped chickadee?
What kind of a chickadee?
Black-capped chickadee.
You know what? That could be it.
Okay. Do you have a bird guide?
Is it smaller than a wren?
Well, it's very small and about the same size as a wren, perhaps, but different body proportions, longer tailed.
Right.
But what comes to mind immediately is a black-capped chickadee. If you talk about that same color combination, it could be a nuthatch as well. But
Now, is a nuthatch the bird that feeds upside down?
Yes.
Ah, yeah, I do have a pair of those that come also to the feeder. It's interesting. I have one of those squirrel-proof feeders, and it has a kind of a web, steel webbing on the outside, and it loves to hang on to that and just turn upside down and feed out of the feeder. The other birds look at it like it's a little crazy, but that's how it feeds.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks, Bruce, for calling. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Bruce. Happy travels.
Yeah, happy travels. Ken in Birchwood, on to you.
Thank you. I'm enjoying the program. Oh, I've got so many questions. I wanted to dovetail on that lady before talking about the migration. I'm very worried about our beautiful loons that will be traveling down this fall and probably nesting or, wintering in those doggone oil-filled marshes down in Louisiana and Alabama.
Mm-hmm. A lot of common loons. Winter in the Gulf of Mexico off of Florida and along the Gulf Coast, Alabama, they will be affected. That will be affected.
I'm worried about that.
I am.
But I really wanted to call to ask you and say that I've really fallen in love with the bluebirds up in the Birchwood, northwest Wisconsin area. The last three seasons, I've noticed bluebirds, and I have put out boxes for them, and they're such an interesting bird, and they have a tremendous interaction with tree swallows. I almost call those tree swallows little Darth Vaders, because they get on my bluebird boxes and intimidate bluebirds so much. I'm trying to find the most optimum area to be putting my boxes, and boy, those tree swallows just seem to be able to horn in anywhere they see those boxes. So I'm having a problem, but it's an interesting one trying to figure it out.
Well, if you put up a number of boxes, how many boxes do you have up?
I have five. I've learned how to make some, and I'll just keep making them. And it's interesting trying to figure out where, because you drive along, you'll see a box along a nothing looking fence line, and I have found that bluebirds actually like to have a little camouflage tree branches around the box so their little ones can get out and have some protection with the branches, or maybe that's only common in my lake area there at Birchwood.
Usually bluebirds would like a perching tree nearby where they can, a lot of birds do this, where they'll come and they'll light on the tree, take a look around, and then approach the box. But usually the box is in the open and not in the trees. It could be on the edge of a field. And how far apart are your boxes?
I have my boxes, depending on my property, I've got two boxes that are within 6, 8, 10 foot of each other, and then another one on the other side of the road, about 30 foot away, and then another on the, two more on the opposite side of my property, like that.
Yeah. Well, 6 foot away is kind of close. There are a lot of bluebird experts that can guide you better in this around the state. There's actually a bluebird society that will give you all the information you need if you go online. But I think you have to space them out. Otherwise, you will have some natural competition for nesting boxes between the two species. And you can enjoy them both. I mean, once they settle in, you'll have both anyways.
Yeah. I do. Thank you very much.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Thanks a lot for calling. Terry from Chippewa Falls wants to know how to attract wrens to their wren houses that they have put up.
All right, Terry. The wren houses have a one-inch hole on them. That's the first thing. To get a wren in the neighborhood is the trick. Once they're there, there's no problem getting them to nest in a box. A wren male, once it establishes a territory, will defend 4, 5, 6 different nest boxes. And once the female chooses one, he'll continue to defend that area. But I have a gourd right out a window here. We hollowed out a hole in that, and it's in that gourd right now. It really loves it. It's in a lilac bush. So if you put out the nests early enough, the nest boxes early enough, and they see them, you can either get a wren or a chickadee in them. And if the hole is an inch wide, if you make it any bigger, you're going to get a starling or a house sparrow or something else in there too. But.
And Patty has emailed wondering if you have a suggestion of a place to see a tufted titmouse in Wisconsin.
Absolutely, right here in my yard. the Chippewa Valley, where is she from?
Doesn't say.
Okay. Yeah, the Chippewa Valley, oddly, is a stronghold for tufted titmice, and they are very common here. And I walk through Putnam Park, I can hear several, some mornings five of them. I'll encounter five of them singing as I go through the park. And it's a southerly bird, so the other places to see them are in the southeast of the state. You can see them from Wyalusing to Rock County and the Sugar River area into Racine and Kenosha County, although they're not as common in that in Racine and Kenosha counties as they are in Chippewa and Eau Claire counties. They're really common here. Madison has some, too. So.
Let's turn to Gordy in Fox Corners. Hi, Gordy.
Hi there. How are you?
Good.
Thanks for taking my call. We have any kind of bird imaginable out here. We were watching the bluebirds dive bombing the blue jays the other day when the blue jays would come to the feeder, and the bluebirds have nests close by. But my question is, we've traditionally had barn swallows here in profusion. This year, we have a different kind of swallow that makes a mud nest with almost a tunnel into it.
Yeah. That's a cliff swallow. I like to call them bridge swallows because you see them on a lot of bridges, but that's a cliff swallow. It has kind of a rusty coloration underneath, but it doesn't have the forked tail. It's like a dark brown on the top of its cap and on its back, and then a rump. It has a light forehead and an orangey rump. Is that the one we're talking about?
Yep. And they went from one nest to three nests and one pair to, there must be a dozen of them out there now.
That's great, yeah. They are a very, very strongly western bird. If you go out west, you see a lot of them. And barn swallows have always been associated with agriculture, but cliff swallows are a little bit more widespread through different habitats, but it's great to see them when they're on a barn. We've got some at a gas station next to where I work that build their little mud nest with a hole in them underneath the eaves of the gas station, and I think it's a little bit of a nuisance, but wonderful birds to have. They don't make a beautiful music, but they sure are colorful.
And thanks a lot, Gordy, for calling. Appreciate it. And Steve, thank you so much. It's been a great joy.
You're
I
welcome.
Hope you'll come back and be with us again.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, appreciate it very much. Steve Bechkal of Eau Claire, author of All of This and Robins Too, A Guide to the 50 or So Best Places to Find Birds in Wisconsin, and his other book, All of This and Titmice Too. Award-winning journalist. He's a great writer, and I liked his poem a lot as well. And I really appreciate having him with us today. And I'm thanking you for listening in, because we've got Joan Houston Hall coming up next. She is chief editor for the Dictionary of American Regional English. And we'll be talking about regional English next here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.